Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
No one ever thinks of Irish sex magic. It's a world where illegitimacy doesn't even exist. She could divorce him if you told other people about their sex life.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer, and what you've just heard there is Dr. Gillian Kenny talking about Brehon Law. This gives you some sense about what lies ahead in this episode, Brehon Law, From Divorce to Irish Sex Magic. This podcast obviously has nothing to do with the story of the Great Famine, but I'm currently preparing the second last episode in the series on the Great Hunger, and this interview is a fascinating special episode to tide you over until that's ready. It returns us to the world of medieval Ireland and the early series I made on the Vikings, Ireland's High Kings and the Norman Invasion. Brehon Law was the legal system of medieval Gaelic Irish society. And while this might sound dry, it's actually one of the most requested episodes since I started making podcasts back in 2010. This is in part due to the many myths that surround the topic. So for this episode, I've interviewed Dr. Gillian Kenny, who'll reveal the real history of Brehon Law, which, as the opening excerpts revealed, is quite different than what you might expect, but it's absolutely fascinating. Before we begin, as always, I want to thank the patrons of the podcast. People have asked why I mention this in every episode, and simply put, I wouldn't be making this show without patrons, so thanking them is an integral part of every episode. Patrons are listeners just like you who sign up at patreon.com/Irish podcast and contribute whatever they can afford to the making of the show. Over the last few weeks, several listeners have become patrons, and this has gotten me closer to the target of hiring a researcher, which will help to create even better episodes going forward. Listeners like you who become patrons get lots of bonus features like early access to the show, episode guides, and bonus podcasts. I've also a very special feature coming up to conclude the Great Famine series exclusively for patrons, but more on that in the next episode. In each episode, I thank individual patrons, and today I want to thank Sally Shin, Michael Ash, Leonard Rafferty, Lena Goldberg, Conrad O'Dea, Jamie Fern Wexler, and Kate Crowley Rosenberg. If you want to get the extra features and support my work, you can sign up today at patreon.com/Irish podcast. That's patreon.com/Irish podcast. Now, as you might be able to hear, I have a cold coming on, so I'll leave it there and get straight into the interview with Gillian, which I began by asking her to explain Brehon Law and where it came from.
Brehon Law is basically the law of Gaelic Ireland. It takes its name from the Gaelic for judge. It's a very complex, very sophisticated system of law. It's mainly civil. So, for example, if you murder someone or you attack them, you have to pay a fine. It's a very unequal system of fines because it depends on which kind of grade you are within society. So it's a very hierarchical system. Nobody has equality before the law. It was the same across all of Ireland, which is unusual. So basically, a judge could travel around Ireland and meet out the same kind of judgments, and that would be accepted, which is unusual in a very tight-knit, very rural and localized kind of society. Where did it come from? There's lots of different opinions on that. We know it was first written down in the 7th and 8th centuries. That is the kind of the main tenets of it. Unfortunately, we don't have any case law from it, so we don't know about judgments given. It then evolved between about the 12th and 16th centuries. And they're the kind of books that we know of today that we use. And within those, there's a lot of commentaries written on them. So we know that the laws as they stood were interpreted differently according to the person and the time with which in which it happened. So again, it's that idea, it's sophisticated. There's an idea. There's lots of mad ideas about Brehon law, but you know, a lot of people say it goes back to kind of the Stone Age. And so it's very difficult to know when it started. There's no doubt when it was written down in the 7th and 8th centuries, it was by then probably quite an old system of law. So it probably goes back to, it may go back into prehistory, but you know, again, it's not the same. It's never exactly the same. It changes according to what the times need. So the central tenets can sometimes change and evolve as a body of law should do. And I suppose that's kind of where it came from, as far as we know.
For people who've come across Brehon law, they've probably come across it online, and there's a lot of references to it being utopian, and it's not really a new idea. Like James Connolly, a leading figure in the 1916 Rising, would have talked about early medieval Irish society being almost a form of primitive communism. So I guess, can you just talk a bit about this idea that Brehon law was a utopian society almost, or a far better way of running a society than maybe it's than similar legal systems that would have existed at the time?
Yeah, sure. So I think you're absolutely right. It is quite an old idea. It's the idea about Brehon law being somehow superior to everything else is tied in with this idea of the noble Gael and stuff like this, and that's coming out in the 19th century and beyond. So it wasn't a utopia, is it, in a nutshell, Irish society in the Middle Ages. It was intensely hierarchical. It was a patrilineal society. I study Irish women. Your life was, as a woman, for example, your life was very much trammelled in by people who had control over you. So, for example, as an unmarried woman, it would be your father or your uncle or your brother. As a married woman, it's your husband, to a large extent. And then as a widowed woman, it would again revert back to another male. So if you compare that to then, say, the common law, which was running parallel to Gaelic law in the medieval lordship, single women had much more rights to enter into business, dispose of their property and stuff like that than similar Gaelic women. So in those kind of terms, it's not. I think it can be looked on as a utopia, maybe by people who think it was sexually much freer and things like that. And they talk about the idea that people could divorce at will. What they're not looking at is the fact that I've seen in the records where divorcing at will generally meant a man walking away from a wife and children and then becoming basically indigent poor and appealing for help. So there's a whole fantasy about, you know, an equality of sexes, which doesn't exist in medieval Ireland. There's no doubt about the fact that the more upper class you were, especially as a woman, you had more rights. But it is an intensely hierarchical society. The idea of your status denotes everything. So in that sense, it's as far away from communism as you're likely to get. There's a lot of stuff on the internet about it. I see, especially on a lot of Irish American websites, about it being this amazing way to live your life in some kind of golden age. No, it wasn't. Tenants under a Gaelic lord, much like tenants everywhere else in Europe, suffered. There's a particular practice which Gaelic lords inflicted on their tenants where they went and visited them, and they would have to look after the lord and his retinue, which often bankrupted them and completely put them out of business, which caused misery. There's a lot of slavery in medieval Ireland. It's by no means, in terms of medieval society, it's much like anywhere else. However, what's interesting, and I think this is where people get the idea, is the fact that according to the law texts, there are 9 different types of marriage. Unfortunately, people who don't read into it seem to think that this designates a kind of free for all. But if you read the text, it's again centered on on your status, on who you marry and what you bring with you to the marriage. And that determines the rights you have. And within those nine types of marriage, basically types of marriage that just stop short of sexual assault or may involve that. So it's not exactly ideal, but it is a myth. If I literally had a pound for every time someone said to me Gaelic Ireland was much better or the Brehons were much better. It's reductive anyway, isn't it, to kind of compare to anything else, because each system has its own pluses and minuses. But I would say on balance, life was difficult if you were poor. Life was better if you were rich. And in a nutshell, that applies generally across a lot of societies in the medieval period. So it's by no means better.
So following on from that then, maybe we could talk a little bit about the position of the poor in general, because under a lot of medieval law, the position of the poor is almost non-existent. What position do poor people have? I guess what I'm thinking is under, say, in urban areas in the later Middle Ages, you start to get the emergence of certain rights for people who are poor. Obviously, in medieval Ireland, you don't have urban centres of such a size. So could you talk a little bit about that, maybe?
Within Gaelic Ireland, you weren't getting urban centres. Again, the complexity of the laws refers to the different types of poor that you have. You have bondmen and bondmaids. So what's interesting is things like, for example, as well, which tells you something probably about the type of society it was. So there's an Irish kind of it's a word called a cumal, which means a female slave. And that becomes used as like a monetary value. So you'd pay for things in cumals. It means three milk cows. So it's an interesting debate around it, because the idea is that female slaves were highly valued, but they basically had no protection under the law. But they were so highly valued that they became synonymous with a kind of a unit of it's not currency, but like a unit of currency. But they didn't have value under the law. As far as I can remember, the only value a female slave had under the law was if she was raped, and the honor price was then paid to her husband's owner. So that's the kind of society that you're talking about. In terms of the poor themselves, it is a society, I think you have to remember, that is in love with the warrior kind of caste. So you see it in the literature. All of the Irish myth cycles are about that type of raiding activity and the warrior preoccupations. It is a very patriarchal society. Land is handed down from father to son, with few exceptions. If a girl inherited, she generally married her cousin, because otherwise it left the family. So it is a society which is in love with the upper classes, which always comes as an amazement to people who might chat about it. They seem to think it's some kind of egalitarian utopia. No, it most certainly isn't. So to be poor, like at any other stage, really was difficult. However, what I've seen in my work and in the work of others, and particularly for women, which I concentrate on, is when you look at, and they're not great, but when you look at town records in later medieval Ireland, where you have urban centres, and they are, of course, where common law runs, they're run by the English, you get quite a lot of Irish female names amongst the servants. And it could be that it was seen as an escape, much like the city was everywhere else in the medieval world. So as a unmarried, for example, female, lower class female in the Gaelic world, your value is extremely low. However, your stock rises if you go to the city and get a job, then you can save. And then you can make your own way in the world a little bit more. So you do come across it a little bit. So it may be that was a way out for some women out of that kind of poverty. But our records aren't great. So there's a lot of supposition there.
Maybe we could tease out a little bit more just around the issue of divorce, because I think certainly in emails and things that I've gotten over the years, people talk a lot about or ask a lot about this issue of women being able to divorce, and I think people probably think about it in a very profound, very modern understanding of that term. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So, you could divorce at will, according to Gaelic law. So again, what you have to think about is a balance of power within a relationship. So very few women would actually, in practical terms, divorce their husband. Because why? Because they would, again, go under the sovereignty of their father or older brother or uncle. As a married woman as well, they had, if they were a married woman of equal status to their husband, they would have certain rights about disposing of property and of negating foolish contracts he'd entered into, which they would immediately lose if they went back to the single life. As the wife, for example, of an important chieftain as well, a woman was also entitled to certain rents, which were traditional rents on his land. So it's a separate form of income for her. There's plenty of examples of women managing the goods they brought with them to marriage and getting up to all sorts of shenanigans with them. For example, there's some instances where women's dowries consisted of mercenary soldiers, and they maintained them after marriage. In a sense, they told them what to do. There's examples in the annals of women raiding and attacking their husband's enemies using their own soldiers and using their own resources. So there's an amount of freedom there which women wouldn't necessarily want to give up. Lower down the social scale, you're much more dependent, of course, on your husband. You've much fewer options, so a divorce probably wouldn't be on the cards. But if you wanted to, you could divorce your husband for a numerous amount of things. So the famous ones are, of course, if he's too fat, which everyone laughs at because there's no equivalent. A husband couldn't divorce a wife for being too fat. But again, this is to do with, really a biblical injunction on husbands to have regular sex with their wives. And the idea is if they're physically incapable, which is what's signaled by being too fat, then the wife had the right to divorce him. She could divorce him if he was impotent, if he was sterile, if he joined a monastic order, if he told other people about their sex life, if he was homosexual. So there were ways and means of doing it. And similarly, a husband could divorce his wife. What's interesting is the reasons indicate the feelings at the time about what was important. So the husband could divorce his wife if she couldn't bear children, which was of primary importance in an Irish marriage, if she aborted a baby as well, and if she was, not loyal to him, if she was off having affairs and stuff. So, but again, it's there in the laws. But the extent to which, I mean, certainly from what I've seen, men did do it. They did walk away. But for women, once they start to have children, it becomes more problematic as well, because, of course, your husband has custody of your children. So you lose them as well. If it ends. So that's another big issue for women. So no doubt the freedom is there in principle, but whether it was actually there in practice is another issue altogether.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Just moving the conversation on then, something that I'm interested in is just the conflict maybe between Brehon law and how much it interfered in people's lives. I'm thinking today a source of tension or conflict in society is the rights of lawmakers to comment on people's sex lives or sexuality. And does Brehon Law have anything to say on this issue?
I mean, in the sense that they wanted spouses to stay loyal so the offspring could be guaranteed, which is important in an illegal sense. But most of what was said about people's sex lives in medieval Ireland comes from the church. No surprise. There's a lot of stuff in the penitentials, for example, which are the kind of guidebooks about sin, which were circulated then amongst the clergy, which talks about punishments. They talk a lot about punishments for sexual acts. It appears to have been front and centre. No surprise there. It tells you quite a bit about what was or what might have been going on. The problem is, of course, is you look at these kind of old manuscripts and documents and you think, did it actually happen or is this what they're afraid of? But anyway, that's what's there. So it's front and centre to their concerns. So, for example, the stuff in there that's quite surprising, though, as well. I mean, Gaelic Ireland is a society in which relationships are multifarious. They're much like, they're not at all like what people imagine the past to be. So there are families in Gaelic Ireland where, you know, you have a stepdad, you have a stepmother, you might have a couple of mothers because your dad might have a wife and a concubine. You'll have stepbrothers and sisters. You may have English stepbrothers and sisters. You may have Gaelic stepbrothers and sisters. There's lots and lots of types of families that existed in Gaelic Ireland and to a certain extent on the border areas between Gaelic and English areas that people today would find much more recognisable than the idea of a nuclear family, although that's never really existed in Gaelic Ireland. It is about your sprawling kin and it's about people, adults who enter into short-term relationships. There's a part in the Brehon Laws, there's one section that talks about it as well, which is interesting. If a husband can't give a wife a baby, if there is, you know, something that's not quite working for him, she can go and get impregnated by another man and the husband can bring that child up as his own. So when you talk about that, it's a kind of a world which now we are becoming a bit more familiar with. It's by no means the more frigid and, you know, colder world of the kind of noble Gael, who was a strong Catholic that dominated the ideas about Gaelic Ireland for like the 19th century and maybe into the 20th. It's a society where relationships begin and end. It's a society where a woman can come along to a chieftain and say, you and I slept together a year ago. Here's the baby from that. And if the chieftain accepted him, the baby became one of the claimants to the chieftain's title. It's a world where illegitimacy doesn't even exist. They've no conception of it. So it is something that, you know, for Ireland today, which is massively changing socially, it's a time that I think we can probably much more identify with. Of course, it's not the same, but there is an idea. There's a give and take in the idea of relationships, which is reflected in the law codes because they try to cover for it. They say there's 9 types of marriage because they know people are out there doing these things and they want to give some kind of legal framework and protection to the people involved in this, particularly, as was usually the case, the ones who suffered were women and children who weren't covered by a legal framework. But the church was, as the Middle Ages went on, more and more against it. So 11th and 12th centuries, they brought out lots of reforms to try and stop this, but they never really stopped it through most of the Middle Ages. Especially in Gaelic areas, which were maybe far away from crown forces, you still do find, you know, areas where priests have wives, bishops have wives, and are accepted as such and are kind of eulogised in the annals, and major families would marry a child off to a bishop. And in the penitentials as well, they talk a lot about things like they'll talk about abortion, which again was a hot topic in Ireland recently. The penances they give for abortion, though, are quite low. For example, in one of them, they give a penance for 4 to 5 years for oral sex, and abortion, the penance is 6 months. So there's a realism there. There's an acceptance that this is happening. And also, of course, this is the idea which happened as well in the Middle Ages, that the church didn't believe that the fetus was viable until ensoulment had taken place. So there's issues about when the abortion happened and so on. But there is a recognition that in a world where relationships changed or could change or could be added to, or people died and married again. And again, of course, there's no such real thing as marriage, not religious marriage. Marriage was a secular affair. So marriage was a contract entered into by two families, and then they'd often have a bit of a feast. But, you know, people for most of the Middle Ages didn't formally go to church. They didn't have a big marriage ceremony. That's all quite recent. That's post 16th century. So they just turned up, had a marriage. They went, yeah, I'll take you, you take me, more or less. And that was it. And then so there's no idea of, kind of, as I've said, illegitimacy, because it wasn't a thing in Gaelic minds until later on. So, yeah, the laws, I would say, were accepting of a society where relationships changed. The church tried to control it, but to a large extent failed quite a bit in the Gaelic lordships.
And then I guess this, given we're talking about the later Middle Ages, things like magic, superstition and witchcraft, I think are probably never far from people today thinking back on it anyway. And certainly it is a feature of later medieval society in the Norman colony. You can see it in things like the witchcraft trial in Kilkenny in 1324 and elsewhere. Is this a feature in Gaelic society, and in particular, is it covered under Brehon law?
Well, yeah, so you do get it. You do get references to it. So what's interesting in Gaelic society, of course, is the fact that the literature is full of really strong magical women, like, for example, the Morrigan, who uses battle magic, which is referenced. So you also get a reference to a magical practice. It's not a female one, but you get a reference to Druids using a poppet as well in one of the tracts. So they go up to the top of a hill where there's a hawthorn tree. They have a poppet of an individual they want to harm. They take a thorn from the tree and then they keep pricking it and saying this ritual kind of thing about hurting this individual. So definitely the magical rituals are involved in life in day to day. You do get like women who are involved in magic, like in the rest of the Middle Ages. Women became associated particularly with love magic, and that's what they're associated with, and especially in the eyes of the clergy in Ireland. The Deer's Cry, which is a poem, a prayer ascribed to St. Patrick, he asks for help against the spells of women, smiths and druids. So there's this idea that women do have this otherworldly power. No further mention is made of smiths and druids, but that's fine because women tend to be the scapegoats. And there are references in some of the legal texts to what's I mean, it's a type of sex magic. So, but it's designed. No one ever thinks of Irish sex magic, but so this is kind of negative sex magic. So it's actually called a literal translation of what's happening is the supernatural attack of a bed. So what the text refers to is the idea that either a woman or a third party curses her husband so he cannot have sex with her. Now, why would you do that? Well, you do that because the law tracts say that you can divorce him if he's impotent. So, I mean, the idea of what they would have used is you know, intriguing as well. So they may have used a charm, some kind of spell. Irish people were petrified of charms to a large extent, but they saw great power in them. Or there's an idea as well that they use some kind of ritual object in the bed, and that stopped the man from performing. And so she could then get a divorce from him. But there's also very famous examples, of course, as well in the lives of the saints, of saints basically performing magic. So Saint Bridget was approached by a man, and he's described as a man who his wife hated, which is always nice. And he asked Saint Bridget for help, and she kind of blessed some water. She said ritual words over it and sprinkled it on the woman, and then she loved her husband forever. Saint Bridget also made a fetus disappear, along with several other saints whose hagiographers thought it's fine, they can make a fetus disappear. which is interesting because the audience who would listen to that obviously didn't think that would have been massively shocking. And again, it ties back to the idea that abortions happened then and they were a part of life, which is attested to in the literature and the laws. So, yeah, there is magic. There is magic. There's people who practice magic. There would have been the magical class, you know, who were called the Druids. These appear to have been predominantly male. There's very few references to female practitioners of anything, really, in the Irish texts. There's an early reference to a female physician. An interesting one, though, is everyone hated female satirists because there's a branch of poetry called satire, which I'm sure you're aware of, and that was seen to be magical because it could have real world effects. I mean, you could kill someone with a satire. So everyone dreaded female satirists, and it was said that they shouldn't have custody of their children because they were just appalling. Again, probably it's to do with the fact that it is a subversion of the common good to have a female magician, to have a woman who can wield that kind of power is an uncontrollable element in a strictly hierarchical and patriarchal society. So that is something to be deeply feared, and that informs views of women performing magic. So it's probably more to do with that than the fact that there was a witch on every corner, which I sincerely doubt, but you know, you never know.
So you've been talking there about, I guess, a legal system that exists for the guts of 1,000 years.
Yeah.
So if it comes to an end then sometime in the 16th century, can you explain maybe how it unravels, or is it?
It doesn't really come to an end abruptly. It's a long, painful, drawn out process, to be honest. Once the Tudors turn their attention to Ireland, everything starts to unravel. So Henry VIII declared himself King of Ireland in 1541. Of course, the dissolution of the monasteries started shortly before that in Ireland as well. You begin to get English adventurers a bit later on turning their attention towards Ireland as a source of profit, and especially under, say, Elizabeth. And into the 17th century, there's just an endless series of genocides and famines and land grabs and ancient kind of families being, you know, bardic families and Brehon lawyers being turned out of where they lived, and the old system being dismantled thanks to rebellion and put downs. And eventually, by the end of the 16th century, after the plantations and the horrendous, Cromwellian interludes and so on, Gaelic Ireland was basically wiped out to a large extent, and the culture that went with it disappeared. As the whole idea behind it, the Tudors begin to look at it and everything is characterized as barbarous. That's not to say it wasn't before, you know. I mean, this incidents in the Middle Ages where, you know, there's 1298 and the Parliament is convened in Ireland, an Anglo-Irish Parliament, and they say, you know, Englishmen have to stop looking and behaving like Irish men and stop taking Irish wives and stuff like that. You know, the idea is that the Irish were barbarous and less civilized, but that really reaches its pinnacle in the Tudor period and beyond. It's a gradual breakdown. It's a slow and very tragic ending, really. I mean, say what you like about it, it was a very complex and a very sophisticated system that worked for people within those rural areas dominated by the Tua. And it was a remarkable system because it went along with a Gaelic culture that stretched across the Irish Sea. So they could, a Brehon could travel from Ireland and into Scotland. A poet could as well. And it's a similar type of universal Gaelic culture, which basically came to a sorry end. I mean, a lot of people say it kind of ended, you know, after the flight of the Earls and stuff like that. It took longer than that. There's still some evidence of law school in the early 18th century, but it dies out. The country couldn't maintain that culture anymore. There was the systems that held it in place disappeared and were swept away in the face of Well, I suppose the only thing you could call it is genocide. So it's a viable attempt to wipe out a culture, and it almost worked, but didn't quite. So, yeah, we lost a lot, obviously, from it. But I mean, again, enough survived that we can track and trace the culture and see the effect it had on Irish society over 1,000 years. And it is remarkable, the kind of stuff that went on. And the kind of society that upheld it.
I'd like to thank Gillian for taking the time to talk to me. You can find Gillian on Twitter at Medieval Jill. That's Medieval, G-I-L-L. So it's Medieval Jill, all one word, on Twitter. In the next episode, I'll be returning to the story of the Great Hunger, where we will see how it came to an end, focusing on my hometown of Kilkenny and one of the city's most famous rebels, the Fenian James Stephens. Until next time, slán.
If you're concerned about mental health or looking to get into self-improvement, join me at the Piece by Piece podcast. There, I'm interviewing everyday people and experts alike about how to overcome difficulties around mental health. Speaking of which, I just released an interview with a mental health historian and another with two friends who are healthcare workers.
If these conversations interest you, check us out at Piece by Piece. That's Peace with an A, B-I, and then Peace with an I. Thank you so much.